From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, Doors Open Milwaukee will have more than 170 buildings open to the public this weekend, but the spotlight this year is on the Near West Side.
If you took away this slice of the city of Milwaukee, you take away a significant chunk of what Milwaukee is.
Then our new series, Healthy Body Basics, gets underway with a very simple goal.
We want to teach people that there are simple tips and tricks and things that we can actually add into our everyday lives to make your breathing better, your standing better, how you move.
Bubbler Talk finds out what happened to a Milwaukee underground comics artist, and a conversation with rock and roll icon Todd Rundgren. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Bonnie North. All weekend, more than 170 buildings in Milwaukee not normally open to the public are. Doors Open Milwaukee is a citywide event that's put on by Historic Milwaukee, Inc., a nonprofit group working to increase public awareness of Milwaukee's history and architecture. Last year, more than 31,000 people explored buildings and sites all over the metro area. Well, this year's Doors Open Milwaukee also takes place across the city, but the featured neighborhood is the Near West Side. I'm joined in the studio by the executive director of the Near West Side Partners, Keith Stanley, and by Historic Milwaukee's events director, Grace Fuhr. Grace and Keith, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Doors Open Milwaukee, how many years now, Grace, has this been going on?
This will be our 9th annual Doors Open.
And so this time it's focused on the Near West Side, and I want to find out what it is about that part of town. What was it historically, architecturally, that makes this such a compelling place to focus Doors Open?
Well, Bonnie, I was driving to today to this appointment to be on the air, and I was driving down Wisconsin Avenue, and I saw the sun, you know, gleaming on these beautiful historic architecture that we have along Wisconsin Avenue. And this is all west of I-43, so not even downtown. And I just thought if you took away this slice of the city of Milwaukee, you take away a significant chunk of what Milwaukee is, from the beer barons who line the formerly Grand Avenue, now Wisconsin Avenue. You take away Milwaukee. If you take away the III Shrine Center, that would probably take billions of dollars, if not trillions, to be replaced. You take away a slice of Milwaukee. You take away some of my historic buildings like the Rave, Eagles Club, the Ambassador Hotel. I think Milwaukee is not the city of what it is today without the Near West Side and the beautiful architecture that lines Wisconsin, State Street, Wells, Clybourne. And so we're glad to be a part of this Doors Open, be a featured neighborhood.
One of the things I find so interesting about that part of town is that it's an area of extremes. Like you mentioned the Beer Barons, you know, you've got the Pabst Mansion, you've got the III Shrine, you've got all of that. And then you've got things like the Ambassador Hotel, which was part of the Green Book, where African Americans could come and be safe and stay in a
safe place.
And so you've got very much working class, you've got a racial interesting mix there, and you've got extreme wealth, all in this part of town.
The Near West Side, and we're proud to state that we our population, our demographic reflects that of the city, probably being really diverse, 38% African American, 35% white, and a growing number of other, our Hispanic brothers and sisters, our Hmong brothers and sisters, Burmese, it is growing. And so we're excited to be a part of that. And I will go back to Bonnie, what you said. You said something that was really valuable. My work in the Near West Side for the past 15 years, we've talked a lot about extremes in this country now and inequality. What was really cool, I think, about the Near West Side as it was growing pre-turn of the century and pre-1900s and then into the 1900s was that the workers who worked on the manufacture of the Harley-Davidsons, who brewed the beer, they were blocks away from the beer barons. They saw the wealth and they saw what they could become and what they could do if they worked hard in this and that environment. And to me, it's fascinating that we're that stretch of neighborhood brought so many people together. You're rubbing elbows with all type of people. So you could see the Captain Paps as he hopped on his carriage or whatever to go manage the company. That's quite fascinating to me that we had that mix of population within the community and still look at that today.
So, Grace, as far as historic Milwaukee is concerned, is this the first time you focused on this neighborhood?
This is. For Doors Open, we've never focused on the Near West Side before. We just started doing spotlight neighborhoods as part of Doors Open in 2016, and each year we choose a different neighborhood. And a lot of what motivates the spotlight neighborhoods is a very strong commercial corridor and buildings that people would be able to tour throughout the event. So, clearly, Wisconsin Avenue is a really great commercial corridor. Last year, we were on Mitchell Street and King Drive, but we just were very excited to work with Keith, and we actually met with him 2 years ago to talk about this as a possibility, and Wisconsin Avenue was under construction at the time. So now that that is all beautifully reconstructed, it's a really great time to be in the neighborhood and featuring it there. We have in the past done Spaces and Traces, which is our residential tour in the Concordia neighborhood, and we've had other special events with homeowners in that area, more focusing on the residential side. So it's been exciting to get to know more of the commercial side of the neighborhood, because there's a very strong business corridor, I would say, but there's also very strong residential groups in those neighborhoods.
Well, Keith, like you were saying, people lived right near where they were working this neighborhood came up.
That's correct. And so you have neighborhoods like Merrill Park, where you had Henry Meyer actually living in the neighborhood. You had neighborhoods historic Concordia, which had the college, Concordia University, there with the professors living right in the community. So there you have this mix of these multi-units, but along with these beautiful, large Queen Anne Victorian homes, where people, once again, you live there, you work there, at one point, seven hospitals. So very vibrant community with a mix of people.
What is the geographic boundary of the Near West Side?
On the east, it's I-43. So we have a portion of what formerly was the Torrey Hill, the former Italian community. So east is I-43, west is 175, south is I-94, and the north is, depending if you're west of 27th Street, it's Vallette. If you're east of 27th Street, it's Highland. And so that's pretty much how it was for the past 80 years for the city of Milwaukee. And so when the Near West Side Partners came about in 2014, we pretty much kept those original boundaries, keeping with the seven historic neighborhoods within the Near West Side.
So when your organization did come into being, what was the purpose behind that? Was it to develop, redevelop, you know, save buildings from being torn down, all of those things?
I would assume Grace would appreciate this. It's two sides of the coin, sustain and revitalize. I think that the Near West Side Partners, along with our 28,000 residents and 370 plus businesses, realize that we inherently take away the fabric of the Near West Side if we remove, if we are intent upon removing some of the architecture, most of the architecture. So we want to sustain what we have there, sustain the beautiful community, sustain the people who live there, the homeowners, the renters, who all make Near West Side what it is, but also then revitalize our commercial corridors, revitalize the spirit of entrepreneurship in the Near West Side. So I mentioned some of the beer barons. So we had Harley Davidson, we had Miller Coors, we had a number of entrepreneurial businesses that came out of the Near West Side that were hoping to revitalize and bring more entrepreneurs into the community. So it's two-sided, sustain and revitalize, keeping in mind that that architecture really makes us who we are.
So, Grace, when people take the tour and they go on Doors Open this coming weekend, what do you think they're going to be most surprised by if they don't already live in the neighborhood?
I think that they'll be surprised by, as Keith was just saying, some of the really incredible architecture, but also some really neat community stories. So one that is a little bit lesser known is the Hands in Harmony Piano Studio, which is located on 33rd and Highland, and it's in a historic Eschweiler-designed mansion. It's right across the street from where some Harley-Davidsons lived historically. They focus on teaching over 200 kids how to play piano, so it's a really great mission. And at their building during Doors Open, you'll be able to kind of learn how to play piano and also do some art-led activities with artists working in education in their back lot there. So I think that's a really neat story that people will be able to learn about. Another one, if people haven't already visited the Evicted exhibit at the Tower Theater and Mobile Design Box, that is located on 27th and Wells. And that building itself is really fascinating. It was built in 1926 as a movie theater by the same architect that built the Oriental. So people can peek their head in the theater. And then they can also see the National Building Museum built an Evicted display, which is based on Matthew Desmond's book, Evicted. So people, for the last weekend of September, they'll be able to see that on display, and that's a really moving exhibit. Central Standard Craft Distillery is one that I'm very excited about. People probably know the name from their Walker's Point tasting house, but they actually have their 10,000-square-foot facility where they make all of their spirits and distill in the Near West Side. So people will have a rare opportunity to tour that building.
And is that a building that they reclaimed, that they revitalized?
Yes. As far as I know, it was historically a warehouse space that they have new manufacturing in. So there's a lot of history there, like the Milwaukee Academy of Chinese Language School is going to be part of it. That's was historically a hospital in the 1920s. But
One of the seven. Milwaukee Emergency Hospital. Yeah. Yes, one of the seven.
Wow.
Yes. So that's a very historic building, but a newer story that you can learn about there. And something that's going to be going on at the Milwaukee Academy of Chinese Language and on Marquette's campus at the Haggerty Museum of Art is a couple of live dance performances happening throughout Doors Open. So we're kind of trying to bring more than just an opportunity to see these architectural spaces in the neighborhood, but also bringing alive the neighborhood with special performances.
And so, Keith, you know, it's going to be great getting people into the neighborhood. What do you hope is a long-term result of having folks walk around and experience a neighborhood that they might not have already?
Bonnie, I don't steal any thunder from Grace, but ultimately on the higher level of having Doors Open in the city of Milwaukee is having everyone have a greater appreciation for our buildings and for our architecture and for our history and, quite frankly, for our culture on who we are as a people, and that's reflected in our buildings. On more on the macro level, I think, for the Near West Side, we are hoping, as a part of our branding efforts, that we're able to get new faces in the door to see the Near West Side in a different light. There's so many good things happening. More businesses are coming to the Near West Side. More people are moving and living in the Near West Side. And we're seeing such a increase in the momentum of how people view this is just quite exciting to be a partner with a historic Milwaukee on bringing people to this neighborhood. Grace mentioned a number of different sites, including Central Standard Distillery, Hands in Harmony, and then, you know, I think about the Catholic Financial Life building with the swim pool at the top. I think that's Milwaukee's only rooftop swimming pool. I think about the Triple I Shrine Center, the Rave Eagles Club, and all of these beautiful buildings that once people get inside, like, wow, I didn't know this was here. And that then hopefully plays into how people view the Near West Side. Maybe it's a place to live. Maybe it's a place to open up a business. Maybe it's a place to invest in. And so we're pretty excited to have that opportunity to showcase the Near West Side in a different light.
So, Grace, I know Doors Open is a chance, you know, for people to get out. Are you and the organization also hopeful that people come into these neighborhoods, whether it's the Near West Side or any of the other neighborhoods you've highlighted, and look at it with new eyes and as a possible you know, new business, like Keith said, or maybe I'll move here, or this is a really wonderful place. I had no idea this restaurant was here.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's part of the reason why we started the Spotlight Neighborhood Program. The event is citywide, so there are, of course, sites throughout a lot of Milwaukee's neighborhoods. But we really hope that this is an opportunity for people to spend a lot of quality time there, not just throughout the Doors Open weekend, but that they come back and shop and visit a place that they didn't maybe have the opportunity to see during Doors Open. And that is one of the questions that we ask on a survey that we distribute throughout the weekend. So one question is, did you visit a neighborhood you were previously unfamiliar with? Do you plan on visiting that neighborhood again? And was your perception of the neighborhood increased as a result of the event? And we see really high numbers and results on that. So last year, 68% of attendees visited a neighborhood they were previously unfamiliar with, and 70% said that they would visit the neighborhood again outside of Doors Open to spend more time in that space.
That's really, those are good numbers.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. We're very proud of that. And that is really one of the goals of Doors Open is one is to increase and foster appreciation of Milwaukee's history and architecture, which is our year-round mission as an organization, but really also to get people to explore neighborhoods and visit neighborhoods that they might not have the opportunity or think to visit otherwise.
Now, I know you're going to be very busy during the weekend, but do you have a particular place on the Near West Side that you are looking forward to going to see?
I have personally not seen the Evicted exhibit yet, so I plan on stopping by there. The Triple I Shrine is always a favorite. They have incredible architecture on the interior, and it's one of those buildings that you drive past on a weekly basis and might not be able to go in otherwise. So those are two that I look forward to seeing.
And Keith, I know you live there and mm-hmm. are part of the partners, but is there something you're particularly looking forward to stepping inside?
Well, two items I would share, Bonnie. One is that I always love going to Central Standard Distillery. Shout out to the team over there. It's almost the way the vines grow on the windows and where the sun shines through is almost like a cathedral. And I just love spending time there. The big brass distillery is just a really cool space. So I don't drink, but I love just being a hangout in that space. It's just a really cool, funky space. So I definitely want to visit that. And I will say that, Bonnie, we are working with our Near West Side Partners team. We have been put together a somewhat of a bingo card, and we're hoping that people can, if you go visit a site, you get a sticker. And if you get so many stickers, you get a gift certificate from one of our local businesses. We invested some funds in being able to make sure all our small businesses, because we believe in small businesses, get an opportunity to be a part of this. And so we call it the September Guide to the Near West Side. And that weekend, if you visit six or more sites, you get, I think it's a $5 gift certificate. And if you go above that, you get a chance actually to win a gift package that includes hotel stays, Harley-Davidson swag, Marquette University swag. So we put together a nice package. So we encourage people to visit the website or pick up that card, because we're encouraging people to go visit as many sites as they can. And they're pretty popular. I see Triple I gets a lot of people action.
Well, it's going to be a fabulous weekend. Doors Open is always a great weekend in Milwaukee. And let's hope for good weather. We'll, you know, put that vibe out there that it's good weather. And I want to thank both of you, Grace and Keith, for coming in and sharing a little bit about this year's Spotlight.
Thank you for having us, Bonnie.
Thank you.
Keith Stanley is the executive director of the Near West Side Partners. Grace Feuer is the events director for Historic Milwaukee. Doors Open Milwaukee 2019 is happening right now at over 170 sites across the city. There's a link to a map and more information about the weekend's event at WUWM.com. All right, take a deep breath. Coming up in just a moment, we'll bring you our newest series, Healthy Body Basics. Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR right after this. We are back with more of Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. We kicked off a new series this week, co-produced by Lake Effect contributor Cynthia Akey, who's a certified yoga instructor, a personal trainer, and a wellness coach, and by videographer Lucian Young. Healthy Body Basics will offer tips and tricks to help us breathe better, stand better, and move through our lives just a little bit easier. We should say right up front that none of us are medical professionals and that you should always check in with your doctor before beginning any kind of fitness regime. So to get things started, Cynthia sat down with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to explain the thought behind the series.
Cynthia Akey, welcome to Lake Effect. It's great to have you in the studio.
Well, thank you, Audrey. It's nice to be here.
So give us a little background on yourself. How did you get into health and wellness, not only for your own practice, but helping other people?
It actually started with my own aches and pains, really. So coming to fitness a little bit later in life, you're always doing walking and a little bit of exercise here and there, but nothing that was more connected or more formal. And coming from a place of pain, seeing a chiropractor 3 times a week, dealing with headaches and all kinds of posture issues, how to make that better as you age. I mean, the biggest thing is how do we make the body as comfortable as we possibly can be? And just found a lot of different techniques. Chiropractor took me to gym, taught me how to do some strength training specific to back health. And from there, a friend said, hey, let's go to a yoga class. I'd never been to a yoga class. I'd been trying a lot of different fitness things, trying to find the right fit. And that one was the one that made the big aha moment for me and said, this makes sense for my body and how I can actually both strengthen it and stretch it at the same time. From there, 2 years after taking yoga classes, I got into wanting to actually teach it and bring it to other people, saying if it's helping me this much, I could help other people find that same sensibility within their own body, that build that awareness, knowing simple things that they can do to take care of themselves. And yeah. It just kind of evolves from there. So now we're 15 years later as doing it as a side, originally as a side gig, and 5 years ago going, changing careers and taking this on as being a wellness professional and trying to help people every day.
Well, that's so important because none of our bodies are perfect. We're not feeling great at any point in time.
No, we definitely are not. I mean, and it's unfortunate. Like if you're waking up with a backache or you're carrying something too heavy in your day or just how you're sitting at your desk, if you're a desk dweller, knowing that there's different ways that you can actually change and improve that.
Right. And it doesn't need necessarily an acute injury or some big, life event to spark this kind of change in people. And something we're trying to do here, so this is the first of what will be monthly segments. And listeners might already be familiar with the Fit For You segments, but that's more about formats, different trends. This is a monthly segment about how we can improve ourselves, So can you get into the goal of what we want to do with this?
I think we want to teach people that there are simple tips and tricks and things that we can actually add into our everyday lives to make your breathing better, your standing better, how you move, teaching people better ways and proper ways to actually do simple tasks, things that will improve activities of daily life. Everything from when you're having a stressful day, how you can do a breathing technique to change and calm that down. If you're doing repetitive tasks, gardening, raking, how can you actually do that a little bit healthier, safer for your body? So thinking about structurally how we can actually change that for the future.
And giving tools to do so.
Absolutely. So a lot of just exercises. So we'll be working on just some tips as well as some exercises, strengthening exercises, stretching exercises, as well as some breathing techniques.
So for our first month of Healthy Body Basics, it's all about improving our standing posture. So what do we need to improve and especially be conscious of when it comes to our posture?
Well, typically we tend to stand with not a lot of awareness of how we're actually standing in our bodies. There might be some tightness in shoulders or low back, and just starting to be aware of those areas and how we can actually change those for the better. So things that we are seeing typically when we are with this device-laden world, we tend to have our heads down, our shoulders rounded. We're getting a little bit more strain in our upper backs, which then puts more strain into our low backs with the head posture forward, so that whole text neck issue. So it's impacting the health of our spines, as well as it can impact our balance. So if you think about your heads down all the time, your balance is now shifted way forward, and we may not be countering that with using some abdominal engagement just to help support the spine. And again, that collapsed chest is going to make it difficult, more difficult to breathe. So we might feel a little bit more anxious because we're not getting as much breath into the body as we should.
And it's more than, you know, making sure you're not hyperextending, say, your knees or anything like that. Because does true standing posture, you know, it's total body. You mentioned
it's total
core
body.
And back.
Yeah, absolutely. So it comes from the ground up. So we've got to start with our feet, being aware of how we can stand a little bit more actively in our feet, being kind to our knees so we're not locking into knees, considering the tilt of the pelvis, which, again, we've got a natural curve and a neutral curve going on there, and trying to find where that neutral curve can be to actually help support your spine a little bit better, bringing in some abdominal engagement, some shoulder, just a little bit of contraction just to stabilize the shoulders. Because of that rounded forward posture, we need to tend to draw those shoulders back and down just to help open the chest, to help lengthen the spine through the thoracic region.
And ideally, this helps prevent further injury in the long run, you know, from going from an ache and pain to, oh, my gosh, I need to see a doctor.
Absolutely. I mean, just these simple movements, and they can be done anywhere, from standing in the grocery store, sitting in your car. Like I always tell a lot of my yoga students and all of my fitness students, just adjusting your rearview mirror can be something that encourages you to maintain that tall posture. So sitting tall, and as soon as you can't see in your mirror, you know, like, oh, I'm not
scooch
sitting
up.
I need to be a little bit taller, put a little bit of energetic intention into sitting a little taller and using some of the muscles along the spine to help stabilize that.
I do notice in the morning I need to adjust it up so I can see better. And by the end of the workday, it's like, oh, readjust.
Right. Because you're like, oh, what just happened to my body?
Exactly. And outside of the aches and pains, you know, what can bad posture indicate in someone's body outside of, oh, perhaps they're not correcting it as often as they should?
Are there
deeper things?
There could be other issues. There could be just other dysfunctions that are within the body. It could be just some structural things that are happening. So that might mean getting some other doctors involved to see if there is some other things going on there. Everything from feet to shoulders and hips. Just knowing that there's always someone that is out there to help you to find the right solution for your body.
Now, with good posture, you mentioned we can adjust things in the car. What are some quick tips and tricks? I was thinking about, you know, lately Amazon has been selling those posture correctors, the straps that you put on your shoulders, which is basically a reminder.
It is. You know, and it's funny because two of my sisters actually have scoliosis. So I'm a little bit more, you know, aware of spine issues. But she actually had, like, in the process of going through the whole scoliosis process of having a brace and different shoulder things. And I do remember her wearing something like that. And other people have actually talked to me about, like should I look at getting one of those? Is that really going to help me? And I said, if it's a tool that's going to help remind you to engage the muscles, then yes, I would say do it. But if it's something that you're using it as a crutch, it's not necessarily going to make the most impact for your body. So instead, if you can actually encourage the body to find that correct position on its own and find that sense of strength and stability from within, you're just going to serve your body so much better in the long run.
And we do have an instructional video, tips and tricks of how to improve our standing posture, which you can find at wuwm.com. And Cynthia, thanks for coming in today, and I look forward to the other segments to come.
So do I. Thank you so much, Audrey. I appreciate it.
Lake Effect contributor Cynthia Akey is a certified yoga instructor, a personal trainer, and a wellness coach. She and contributor Lucian Jung produce Healthy Body Basics for Lake Effect with help from Audrey Nowakowski. The tips and tricks Cynthia mentioned are at WUWM.com, along with a video that demonstrates everything that she talks about. And again, a reminder that you should always check with your doctor before starting any fitness regime. Coming up next, Bubbler Talk finds out the fate of a Milwaukee underground comics artist. Lake Effect Weekend continues with that in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
The 1960s and 70s were a time of great change in the United States. The counterculture was well underway. And amidst all of this, John Cervantes, our question asker, was a 15-year-old kid living in West Allis.
I'm going to see Pink Floyd at the stadium, you know. And this was what the kids did. They went to 1812 Overture, Record Head, all these places.
Going to record shops and checking out comics was what John did religiously. But it wasn't your typical family-friendly comics. These comics addressed daring themes like sex, drugs, and the Vietnam War. And that was exactly what John and others like him wanted.
Like I tell you, it wasn't like normal comics back then. It was, here's Richard Nixon talking to John Lennon, you know, and...
What John is describing is a very specific type of comics, not your Batman and Robin and big names like Marvel. No, this was the complete opposite. This was underground comics with an X. For Bubbler Talk, we're diving into the underground comic scene and the role Milwaukee played in the movement. So decades ago, in order to be published and stocked by retailers, comics had to get the stamp of approval from the Comics Code Authority. Here's Marvel comic book writer Steve Englehart talking about the CCA in a History Channel documentary.
This was still the time of the Comics Code. Comics Code had been instituted in the 50s because people were afraid that the youth of America was being corrupted by these evil comic books.
But artists rebelled and went underground, creating a national movement marked by its brash political criticism and innovative styles. But what is often forgotten is the part that local Milwaukee artists played. Here's Marquette Professor of Philosophy and Aesthetics, Curtis Carter, speaking about Jim Mitchell, who he regards as Milwaukee's king of comics.
He's a very talented artist. His work was certainly appreciated in the community and beyond. In fact, I think one of the Beatles actually saw his work and followed it.
The Beatles? Who was this local Milwaukee legend, and where is he now? Turns out, right in Brewer's Hill.
Hi!
Hi!
Jim?
Yeah.
Hey, Angelina!
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Jim was kind enough to invite us into his studio, which could double as a museum of comics and editorial cartoons. There were sketches and drawings full of Jim's early work and more recent portraits. There's one piece that was the cover of the 1970 Bugle American with President Nixon, an American Eagle, and the GOP. Let's just say it isn't flattering to Nixon. And according to Jim, this is exactly why he started drawing in the first place.
The comics I was doing out of kindness, and then it gave me a medium to vent against what the government was doing. They were lying to us on the news at night.
Jim is talking about the Vietnam War. He says that people his age were getting drafted and sent to a war that they didn't understand.
People were very anti-Vietnam War, and we were too.
Jim lent his voice to combat social and political malfeasance and made his mark nationally, as did other underground artists. But Marquette Professor Curtis Carter says that underground comics never succeeded in becoming a major art movement.
The means and the market just sort of vanished.
Underground comics were hard to get. They weren't everywhere. The main place at the time was the Bugle American, an alternative newspaper in Milwaukee. And when that went under, it became even harder to get the comics.
The vehicles for presenting it were limited and just basically went away.
And then, of course, the demand changed. As the counterculture movement faded, so did underground comics, which Curtis says is what happens to most art movements.
Culture is always a moving thing, and as it changes, the ideas change, what artists do change, and if the artists don't change with the times, their work becomes stagnant.
The end of the underground comic scene did not mean the end of Jim Mitchell's legacy. That 15-year-old kid from the beginning of the story, John Cervantes, today, he is the owner of Johnny Hammer's, a restaurant in West Allis. And when you walk in through the door, up on the wall, to your left, you'll see a classic Jim Mitchell caricature, drawn specifically for the place by the king of Milwaukee comics himself. Angelina Moser Salazar, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Potawatomi Hotel and Casino, home to 24/7 entertainment, dining, and musical acts, plus additional hotel rooms and Ember Salon and Spa, opening in August 2019. More at paysbig.com. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit WUWM.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
We'll take one last break and then catch up with rock and roll icon Todd Rundgren ahead of an appearance here on Wednesday. Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR right after this. We're back with Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. Great to have you with us. Any Packers fan worth their salt knows that tune. The guy who wrote it, Todd Rundgren, has been making music for more than 50 years. The multi-instrumentalist has had hits of his own like Hello, It's Me and I Saw the Light, and he also produced seminal albums for groups like Badfinger, Grand Funk Railroad, New York Dolls, and Meatloaf. Rundgren is also a champion of music education, and he runs a foundation to help bring it back to public schools. Rundgren will be part of an all-star cast here on Wednesday when a tribute to the Beatles' White Album comes to the Pabst Theater. We reached Rundgren at his home in Hawaii, and he joins us now. Todd Rundgren, it is an honor and a pleasure to have you on Lake Effect. Thanks so much for taking time to talk with us.
No problem.
And of course, you know, we're really fond of one of your songs here in Wisconsin.
I wonder which one.
I don't know which one that one might be, but you're not going to be playing that one, are you, on this concert?
Well, I only get two songs, and they kind of decided which songs they wanted me to play. It's the same kind of situation as with Ringo, where you play a couple of your own songs, and then the rest of it is the Beatles in one form or another. Yeah, I'll be doing Hello, It's Me, and I Saw the Light. No big secret.
No big secret on those, no. But of course, we are all fond of Bang the Drum.
Yeah, that's it's also my least favorite song to play.
So it's a good thing they told you not to, right?
It's just a bunch of yelling and jumping around. You know?
Yeah, it's a young man's song, right?
Yeah, when I was younger, it was a little bit more fun, you know, but at this point, it's just, I often dread it when I have to pick up the timbale sticks.
Well, we won't make you do it. But you're here, you mentioned Ringo, and you're here in kind of celebration of the 50 years of the White Album. And
I think we missed it by a year. I think it's 51.
Is it 51? Okay, okay, we can't add.
It was 50 years ago last year.
Last year. But you're here to celebrate that album and to participate in that concert. And so what was it about the White Album that made you want to be part of this?
Well, I'm up for doing all of these kind of collaborative things. They're fun tours to do because, the burden isn't all on you. You know, it's spread out. And both in the, in the performance sense and also in, bearing the expenses of a tour, all you have to do is just take your salary,
You just show up,
So it just makes it a lot easier. You're well taken care of usually. And so as a playing experience, it's always easier in some ways, and often it's fun because you're getting an opportunity to work with other players and interact with them. Sometimes you even become influenced by them, and that's ultimately, what musical experience is supposed to be, absorbing other influences and not getting stuck in one place.
Well, and you've got a really interesting group of guys to be playing with on this, too. I mean, those are some really interesting, diverse experiences to bring into the group. I mean, I'm looking at the list. Jason Scheff from Chicago, Joey Mollen from Badfinger, Mickey Dolenz from the Monkees, and Christopher Cross. I mean, it's like you're kind of all over the place in your own individual careers, and it's just interesting that this group is together.
Yeah, well, when the producers go out on canvas, you know, for artists for these things. That's always, you know, somewhat complex formula. First of all, you have people who are inclined to do it. Second of all, you have to find people who are skilled enough to do it. And thirdly, they have to be available to do it, you know, and not doing something else. So it's very tricky, you know, to put together five personalities of any particular professional level, get them all, you know, free of their other commitments, have them all be, you know, competent enough to do it, you know, that sort of thing. So it isn't simply the names, it's the, you have to have a sort of guaranteed skill set within that group of people, and I believe that that's certainly there. The trickiest part, again, was getting everyone free of other commitments.
Had you played with any of these guys before under other circumstances?
Well, I've played under similar circumstances with Christopher Cross in a tour that was called A Walk Down Abbey Road, and the production team behind it is the same as this. So they kind of make something of a practice of trying to find events in the Beatles' career and then duplicate them in the present. So, yeah, I have done that. I have not worked with the with Mickey before, and I have not worked with Jason, but I have, of course, worked with Joey on Straight Up with when Badfinger was young and spry.
Right.
So that was in the 70s, and we really haven't communicated since. So we're virtual strangers to each other as well.
Well, that's going to be interesting to reconnect after all of this time. And, of course, Badfinger was supposed to be, you know, an answer to the Beatles.
Well, they were, you know, signed by Apple, and they did, in that sense, outlast the Beatles. So they could have been, you know, kind of the inheritors of the Beatles' legacy, in a sense.
You've been doing this a long time, both as a player and as a producer. How have things changed in the rock and roll world? I mean, we all know that, like, live has to be the way people make money now, because nobody's making money on albums because everybody downloads it for free off YouTube. But how has that changed the music making, or has it?
This all goes along with the evolution of the delivery system, of the way that people get the music. And there's, you know, upsides and downsides to all of this. The old model essentially involved, the old model, the commoditized model, where you're buying a thing, an LP or a CD or something like that. That sort of depended on a certain amount of control over the audience. The high price point, you know, made people more selective in terms of what they bought. High price point due to the fact that the actual manufacturing costs of the product were relatively low compared to what it costs to get to buy the product. But that also created in the mind of the listener or of the music consumer a greater value in what they had purchased and a greater commitment to listening to it and actually getting that the maximum value out of it. What's happened now that music has become ephemeral, it's now a service, it's not a commodity. It's ridiculous for anyone to buy a song for 99 cents, and I've always said that. If you're going to have subscription services, then have subscription services, but trying to have some sort of hybrid, you know, commodity, but it's actually a downloadable and that sort of thing, you know, that's sort of ridiculous. But the byproduct of that is, there are a couple of byproducts. One is that because the music is so easy to consume and seems to cost so little, people don't value it as much. What they value is the latest thing now. So it is less and less an art form and more a consumable item. And a byproduct of that is a lot of people who claim to be musicians, but making music is only a sideline of marketing their personality overall. So I think in the minds of a great deal of music consumers, and maybe it always was this way because most people don't study music, they either enjoy it or they don't. In the minds of most consumers, they do not not get attached to any particular piece of music, because there is so much music and because something new is going to be begging for your attention tomorrow. It won't be like the old days, you know, where records only got released on certain days and in certain months and things like that, you know. It was all planned around getting people into a record store so that they would buy not just the record they were waiting for, but other records as well. None of that exists anymore. And so the end result is that most of the people making music pretend to take it seriously, but do not. They just as soon be designing shoes or hats or somehow influencing people and getting paid essentially for doing nothing. So that's the state of music nowadays.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Having said that, you know, the upside of the ephemerality of music and the ease with which people can get it is that there are still people who really like good music and will search it out and will commit themselves to listening to and understanding it. It all changed as soon as the Sony Walkman came out and people started carrying the music with them. Suddenly, it's not a quality time experience. You're reading the newspaper at the same time while you're on the subway. You're jogging and thinking about other stuff, and the music is just there to set the pace for you. Suddenly, music is the wallpaper to your life. It's no longer a quality time experience.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I think that's true, and it just...
Well, there's no way to stop that.
Right.
You know, but the point is, it makes the technological, all this technology that we put into music seem sort of superfluous in a way, because it's returned things to the original model. The model where the only way you could make money as a musician was to go out and play music, because there was no such thing as records at the time.
And so
now it's back to virtually the same thing. You can only make money as a musician if you go out and play music. Now, the people most affected by this in the long run are songwriters. If you're writing music but you're not playing it, you're in a much different position and it's much harder for you to collect.
Yeah, and to make a living. Yeah, it's like we're back to minstrel times. You know, you have to go out and the band has to perform and the people have to pay, you know.
Exactly. And if you wrote the song for that band but you're not playing in the band, how do you get paid?
Right. The band's going to be like, wait.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's to some point there will be statutory, you know, every gig you play, some amount. Either the promoter or you are going to have to pay some amount to the copyright owners of the material that you play.
It is a very different world from when I first heard you, and you know, and the White Album and a lot of these other folks. I remember listening to the Monkees as well, and certainly Chicago. And it's like, you know, here we are in 2019, and it's such a different place.
Well, that's the way evolution works.
I guess so. Yeah, so there are times, and most of the time I don't like to look back, but you know, there are times when I think, you know, there was just something so special about putting that album on in your room and really connecting with the music.
Yeah, but that's the thing about evolution. You know, there are, you know, new things being created, but things going extinct as well.
Yeah.
You know, things that don't adapt go extinct.
Well, fortunately, you seem to have adapted.
I have always been somewhat adaptable because I learned how to learn after I got out of school. Most people figure, you know, okay, I'm done school. I've learned everything I need to know now. You know, I'm going to get on with my life. I hated school so much that I learned almost nothing while I was in it. But as soon as I got out of school, I learned how to teach myself. I learned the way that I could, you know, discover things and retain them and prioritize them and that sort of thing. And I haven't stopped since.
Do you find having to reproduce an album or a song exactly the same way, does that take the spontaneity out of it? I mean, to me, part of the fun of playing live is you don't know exactly how it's going to happen because you're in the moment with the other musicians.
Well, that is the challenge, but when you advertise a reproduction, you know, you say, okay, we're going to play all the songs from this record in order, you know, and the way that you remember them, then it's essentially, in a sense, false advertising.
True.
Not to deliver what people remember.
Yeah.
So there certainly is that element, but so much of performed music now is done with the drummer having some kind of time reference in his ear, because things happen at certain times. If you're doing Twist and Shout, when are you going to ever need a click track, you know?
Yeah.
But if you're doing some 7-minute opus, you know, with all these different parts in it and stuff like that, you know, and everybody has to hit certain marks at the same time, sometimes it's the only way you can accomplish it.
Okay, I get that. I get that. And yeah, and people want to hear the White Album because that's what they're coming to hear.
Yeah, and in the White Album, there's really nothing that can't be covered with this group. I mean, Gil, as I say, he can cover 3 keyboard parts. We've got somewhere between 4 and 5 guitar players. It's not as if we don't have enough hands to play guitar. I imagine anything that was originally, you know, an orchestral instrument, strings or anything like that, that'll be covered by the keyboards. We're not going to carry a string quartet around.
Yeah, they eat too much.
Yeah, they're not worth it.
No.
No, actually, I've toured with the string quartet with Ethel several times, and they're just great people and a lot of fun to play with. And also, we're very much aligned in terms of our emphasis on getting kids into music education programs. My foundation, the Spirit of Harmony, is principally focused on helping give people the resources to get music programs back into public schools.
Oh, good for you.
And at an early age and with a formal education, not listening to Cardi B, you know, but actually learning how to play an instrument.
Right, and understanding how it all goes together. I mean, I'm a product of the public schools music system. You know, my dad taught as a music teacher in public schools, and it's made me the listener and, you know, music appreciator that I am today.
Well, that's part of what happens to your brain when you get exposed to music education at an early age. It changes the way you process sound, and that doesn't go away when you get older. So it does make you literally a better listener. You're able to pick out different sounds in a sonically busy atmosphere. You can focus on a person's voice in a crowded room much better because you're able to distinguish the timbres of their voice in the way that you can tell a tuba from a piccolo, you know.
Well, is there a particular song that you are most looking forward to playing from this album?
Well, I've been playing While My Guitar Gently Weeps for literally decades and in dozens of circumstances, so that song was the most obvious one for me to take off the table as soon as I agreed to do this. I said, I'll agree to do this, but I have to play While My Guitar Gently Weeps. It's one of the few Beatles songs that really features a guitar. It's not just simply a guitar solo, but guitar all throughout it. So that's the fun part for me, a chance to noodle around and also kind of not simply tribute the Beatles, but one of my principal guitar influences, Eric Clapton.
Well, Todd Rundgren, thank you for all the music, all the years, and looking forward to a lot more music to come and to having you here in Milwaukee.
Terrific. We'll see you in Wisconsin.
Legendary rock musician, producer, and songwriter Todd Rundgren will be at the Pabst Theater in Milwaukee on Wednesday with a tribute to the Beatles' White Album. There's a link to more information about the show at WUWM.com. And that wraps up our show today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.